Hi, Garner Ted Armstrong. How many times on a clear night have you looked up above and then gone back inside and gotten your family's binoculars and taken a closer look at some of that spatial debris out there? Some of those relics of an ancient cataclysmic explosion of some kind, one of which we call the moon. Most of us take all of those little pinpricks of light that we see on a clear, bright winter night up above pretty much for granted. An awful lot of people could name perhaps a few of some of our own planets in the solar system. We're vaguely familiar from our high school astronomy with the sun and how it works. Or are we? With the moon and some of the distances, and because of lunar landings and the fact that men have actually walked around on the moon, driven vehicles on the moon, brought back samples and lunar rocks, and even driven a golf ball on the moon, we're aware as never before. As never before in the history of humankind, this generation is far more aware of the universe, of what might be out there. And with all of these probes from JPL, and with rockets being launched almost daily, and with hundreds upon hundreds of orbital satellites over our heads made in the Soviet Union or the United States or Japan or West Germany or Britain or somewhere else, we're very conscious, usually, of outer space. We're more and more, as a result of our modern technology today, conscious of the fact of the existence of our awesome universe. But where did all of that come from? When you gaze up there at night and you see all those tiny little winking lights, what are those really? Do you realize that many of those are actually bigger than our own sun? If you were to take a scale model, this is from Peter Millman's book on the universe of space, and try to come up with a model that would tell you a little bit about our own universe and part of our neck of the woods in a galaxy that we call the Milky Way, what would be some of the distances that we're dealing with? How large would the Earth be if you were to compare it with some of the other bodies out here in space? How large, for example, is the Earth in comparison to the Sun? Which, remember, is only an orange dwarf. Our Sun, remember, is one of the smallest of all the stars, because the Sun is a star. And then there are all the planets that are actually captured by the gravitational pull of the Sun and that are part of our solar or Sun system. There are millions, billions, hundreds of billions of suns or stars. Do all of those have planets? There's no way to know. Because, you see, we can barely see with some of the most powerful telescopes some of the bright suns, even a supergiant, so far out there, billions, perhaps millions, hundreds of trillions, who knows, of light years away, and it would be impossible to know whether or not they too may have a couple of dozen planets captured in their own gravitational field, because the returned light from the dim reflection bouncing off those planets would be lost in space and could never penetrate and could not come to our knowledge here on this Earth. But suppose we were to take a scale model where the distance of the Earth to the Sun, 93 million miles, would be just under a quarter of an inch. Now, if you were to pick a dime out of your pocket, or a penny or something, on the scale of that model, the orbits of the four inner planets of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars would fit comfortably on that coin, with the orbit of Mars represented by the outer circumference. The orbit of Neptune, the outermost large planet, would be 14 inches across. Now, on that scale of our model, where would the nearest star to our own solar system be? Now, just take a look at that little dime in your pocket there, or your hand. The nearest one would be 1 mile away from the dime. That's the closest star. The center of our star system or galaxy would be over 6,000 miles, or roughly the distance from maybe London to Los Angeles, California. 6,000 miles away from that dime. And the millions of other galaxies would be so much further away. That comes from Universe of Space by Peter Millman, on pages 15 and 16 of his book. Most of us are unaware of the fact that we're living our lives on a spaceship. I was talking to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar one time when I had the privilege of taking him for a flight in an airplane and driving him along in an automobile, had my picture taken beside him, and I was amazed. I had never realized before that I was a pygmy. But I saw the picture on the wall after they had put it up in the locker room, and here I was with my head barely above this guy's belt. But he was sitting in the front end of a Chevrolet, and I was driving along in northern Minnesota with his knees just about protruding out of the top of the car. I found him to be a very intellectual, very intelligent, very studious, very knowledgeable person. He's quite a private, shy, and quiet person, but a very fine guy to get to know. And we talked a good bit about creation and about the origin of things and about space. And he was himself marveling that human beings talk about going to leave the Earth in some gigantic spaceship, and they have to admit that if they're going to leave the Earth and travel out here in space somewhere, they have to take a lot of the Earth along with them. Quite literally, as we're going to see here in a few moments, they would have to take dirt. They would have to take the plain, good, green Earth along with them to be able to grow and to farm vegetables, to raise cattle and the like, in some fanciful space journey, because we are earthlings. We are earthbound. We are matter. We are from the dust or the dirt, the mud, the clay, the elements, the nutrients of this earth, and back to those elements of this earth shall we go. Now, I know that sounds almost biblical, doesn't it? Well, it's also quite scientific. Your body is a chemical mixture of human sinews, tissues, the molecular structure of your own bones, of your muscles, of your flesh, of your cellular and muscular and circulatory, nervous, all of the various systems that make up your physical fleshly body. And you came from the dirt and the dust of this earth from the time a spark of life was struck, when the ovum of the female was united with the spermatozoon of the male and you began to grow in the womb of your mother. It was those carrots and spinach and rutabagas and perhaps the bread and the celery and the lettuce and tomatoes and the steaks and hamburgers and gravy. All of that stuff was assimilated by the mother's body, and unfortunately along with it an awful lot of soft drinks and who knows, maybe some cigarettes and other stuff along with it. But nevertheless, forgetting the bad parts for the moment, you gradually assimilated in your little growing body, first called a fetus and gradually shaping like a human being and finally appearing to be a little full-developed baby, and you became a fleshly copy of your parents because your mother was ingesting the foods that were feeding not only her body but causing your own to grow. And from the time you began to draw this Earth's atmosphere into your lungs, the three spheres of the atmosphere, the bathysphere, and the lithosphere, the three spheres of this Earth that make up our beautiful, marvelous, green spaceship Earth, you began to have to breathe air, drink water, and eat food, and you assimilated that, and you gradually grew, and you became a part of the water and the air and the food. Now, if you were to go into outer space, you're going to have to take some of that along with you. The gases that we expect are peculiar to this Earth in exactly the right mixture of oxygen so that you can breathe it and you can continue to live. So we sometimes don't realize that we are living in a natural spaceship, that we're taking a journey out here in the midst of the blackness of space. And if we could just understand that concept, we would know automatically that there's something going on out here in this universe, and we would have to ask about the origins of mankind. We'd have to ask, how did all of this get there? And who controls it? Who sustains it? By what law does it act in orderly fashion? Why does it not act in cataclysmic and chaotic disarray? Does harmony come from randomness? Do encyclopedias result from explosions in print shops? If they do, then you can understand the infinitesimally minute little particles of some of the elements underneath your feet, the cleavage properties of minerals, the way certain molecular structure of certain rocks and chemicals and other things inevitably always react in identically the same fashion, according to a law that makes them act that way. And you could begin to understand why you are actually being controlled and bound by law. Now, you don't see those laws. You don't see the law of gravity. You just see how it acts. You don't see some of the laws that affect our physical Earth, our good green planet that is actually a spaceship, a natural spaceship on which we spend our lives, but it acts upon you. And we're rocketing away out here in space around our solar system, which is actually 50 billion, billion times more voluminous than the Earth. Now, inside of our own solar system, the most important thing that we see going on out there, of course, is the sun. Because most people don't even know where the planets are. Even if they were to go out at night, with a pair of binoculars, they would have a difficult time finding where are the planets. The most important one is the Sun. With its 9 planets, 32 moons, 30,000 asteroids, 100 billion comets, and innumerable dust specks and gas molecules. And all of that is only an infinitesimally tiny corner of the universe, smaller than an atom in the corner of a room. The most dominant thing you're aware of out there during the day, and because of its reflected light off the moon at night, is the Sun. And you know that the Sun accounts for 99%+ of the total physical material substance of all of this system of the Sun system or the solar system. The Sun has a diameter of 864,000 miles. That's over 100 times the diameter of the Earth. And according to Fred Hoyle's book, Astronomy, he says the total energy of the Sun emits in a single second. The total energy the Sun gets rid of, gives off, in a single second would be sufficient to keep a 1 kilowatt electric fire burning for 10,000 million years. Actually, the energy the Sun puts out, that huge helium-hydrogen furnace, just like an exploding hydrogen bomb, which is really what it amounts to, the energy it puts out in 1 second, boom, it's already over, is equivalent to the whole total amount of energy the entire human race has consumed throughout all the history of mankind. You know, when you look out there and you begin to wonder about it, doesn't it ever make you think a little bit about how could all of this have happened by accident? And is it an accident? Or was it set there? Was it actually set in motion? Did some great creator being put all of that up there? Or did it just happen? If beauty, harmony, intricacy, interdependency, even symbiosis in some living organisms is the result of an accident, some kind of a happenstance, a complete capricious, chaotic disarray, then your mind is going slightly crazy. Because everything you can know, everything you can sense, everything that is logical and that is rational to your mind tells you that explosions in print shops do not create encyclopedias. That randomness does not create order. And in the universe, in the solar system, in our Earth, we see order. The closer you look at something man has done with his hand, the more disarray, the more confusion. The closer you look at something that God has done, the more beauty, the more intricacy, the more harmony. It has been said that even the finest polished cue ball, if expanded to the sides of the Earth, that is the cue ball they use in playing pool, and you think of how slick and how smooth and perfectly round it appears to be, but they claim if you would expand that to the size of the Earth, that its rifts and valleys and its huge, vast, jagged mountains would be far more precipitous, far bigger, steeper, and more rugged than any mountain range on the Earth. Because you see, even the most infinitesimal little scratches from the finest polishing, sandpapers, or whatever they use to get it that round would be, if magnified to the size of this Earth, gigantic, huge, rugged mountains. So the Earth is actually smoother if you were to shrink it down to the size of a cue ball than is a cue ball. Interesting that under a microscope, if you look at the wing of a fly, or the eye of a fly, the wing of a bird, if you look into the crystals of quartz, or even some of the common things you can pick out of your own kitchen like sugar or salt, you see intricacy and beauty and harmony. And the further you look, and the more you dissect it, the closer you look, the more you take it apart, the more perfection, the more harmony. But if you look at anything, like, for example, a lot of people don't understand how printing is done, like pictures on a magazine, and if you go and you take a course, you pick up a book, you'll hear about the little dots and about the spacing of these dots to create shadows and different colors and the like. But if you were to take a microscope and look, you would find out that the closer you look at what man has done, the less intricacy and the more crudity. That's why in the preaching of the gospel, Jesus Christ of Nazareth talked about the awesome universe a great deal and said, "Lift up your eyes and see who has made these things." Well, I've got to break off there for lack of time. Be sure to write for this booklet on what is the real gospel. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.